at the sound of the funky tone. It'll be 12 days until hope, change, and my sweet outside jump shot come to the White House. See you on Inauguration Day.
Recently, psychologists have determined that childhood teasing might actually be good for kids, teaching them resiliency, which is important to leading a life of achievement. So parents, if your kid is called Four Eyes, Tinsel Teeth, Pencil Neck Geek, Nerd, or Fatty Fatty 2x4 couldn't get through the bathroom door, don't worry. They'll probably grow up to be just as successful as...
For the most entertaining talk anywhere, stay tuned to LA Talk Radio. Your real talk station. Your real 24 hours of commercial-free programming.
Hello? Yes, this is Gray Residence.
Yeah?
Hello, this is Dong Nguyen from Vietnam Community Center.
Yeah?
We're trying to get a signature and a petition to qualify for November election to change name of Garden Grove to New Saigon.
Bullshit. Bullshit. This is Garden Grove. It's not New Saigon.
Yes, but...
Yes, but you people come here to our country and right away you want to change things?
Well, it's tradition.
Tradition, my ass. You people are foreigners here. You want to change things and call it New Saigon?
Yes.
Well, you're full of shit.
New York was named for...
I don't give a goddamn what New York was changed for or anything else. You people just came here, your goddamn boat people off the boat, no money at all, and the first thing you know, you want to own the place?
And even Minneapolis.
I don't give a goddamn about Minneapolis or nothing else.
Yes, but it would be better...
It will be shit. This is Garden Grove. If you people don't like it, go to hell back to Saigon.
Yes, but we can't, because if we do, they will shoot us.
Well, that's what they should do. You come here, you want to change every goddamn thing. You got more now than you ever had.
Yes, land of opportunity.
Yeah, I know. For who? Not us. For you. No shit.
An unexpected pregnancy breaks the monotony of a local woman's menstrual cycle. It's the Onion Radio News. This is Doyle Redland reporting. Area woman Sheila Borkin was nearly ready to climb the walls if she had to endure yet another month of her regular menstrual cycle. But today, Borkin says a recent one-night stand has given her overly predictable hormones the jolt they sorely needed.
I don't think I could have taken another 28 days of this. You have to understand, this was going on for years.
While Borkin plans to terminate the pregnancy in the first trimester, she says the change in routine has inspired her to get pregnant again the next time she falls into a menstrual rut. Doyle Redland for The Onion Radio News, online at theonion.com.
This station presents Real American Heroes.
Real American Heroes.
Today, we salute you, Mr. Guy Who's Turning Into His Father.
Mr. Guy Who's Turning Into His Father.
When you were a kid, you swore you'd never turn out like your old man. But now that you have kids, it turns out you swear just like your old man.
You lousy kids, clean up.
Sure, you want your kids to think you're hip and happening, but still find yourself screaming, "Turn down that awful jungle music for crying out loud!"
And you don't care how you dress.
You've had that members-only jacket for 25 years.
Even the Goodwill doesn't want it.
So the next time you find yourself saying, "Back in the good old days," or "This must be the new man," look in the mirror, ignore your nose hair, and say hello to Mr. Guy Who's Turning Into His Father, a real American hero.
Mr. Guy is turning into his father.
Come here, boy. Pull my finger.
And now, from high atop the LA Talk Radio building, it's time for Sam and Susie in the Morning.
Sam and Susie in the Morning.
Right here on LA Talk Radio.
Good morning and welcome to Thursday, January 8th, another beautiful day in Southern California, another day without Susie, but we do have TJ McCormick in the studio.
Hola, good morning.
Just in time. Yeah. And just enough to save me for myself.
Happy to do it.
Yes. You know, I don't know how you can do 2 hours every day without...
I don't.
You know?
I don't do two. I do. Yeah. I do all together. My 2-hour show is about 45 minutes of good broadcasting. So now is another hour and 15 minutes of what?
Yeah. But that's your show. I mean, that's your world.
Yeah, exactly. The world of TJ McCormick.
So how are you doing, my friend?
I'm all right. I got this chipped tooth and a bottle. It's driving me nuts. I tell you, it's
how did you chip your tooth?
I'm eating a goddamn bagel. Friggin' really? Jewish soul food. Fuck my friggin' teeth.
It's the Jews again.
Goddamn Jews.
I'm telling you.
The thing is, my family has awful teeth. Bad calcium deficiency.
Really?
I think a combination.
Everybody. Really?
We're awful. Awful. Anyway, the thing is that, and what you mentioned yesterday also, I probably am grinding my teeth a bit when I sleep.
Yeah.
At least I know I used to a lot. I think it's kind of my stress levels have gone down, so I think I'm doing it less. But anyway, whatever. What's weird is that my wife, just before she got pregnant, she chipped a tooth.
Really?
Or actually, early in her pregnancy, she chipped a tooth eating like, I don't know what the hell she was eating, but like just a minor little like that, and she hasn't been able to get it fixed because she's pregnant, and she couldn't. The doctor couldn't do what they
you
need
see,
to
I
do.
Can tell you from experience that I've had that also, and I'm not just a clencher, but a grinder. So I've had to use like a night guard and stuff.
Wow.
And because it weakens your teeth. I mean, the jaws are like the strongest bones in the body.
Mm.
So when you press on those, you know, you clench your teeth together, and you grind them, they weaken.
Yeah, well, I tell you what's driving me nuts now. It's not so much, it's not very noticeable. I can get away with it. You know, there's people out there with much worse situations. I can wait until the doctor, I have a really popular dentist, so I've got to wait for this elective, you know, he's got emergencies and stuff. And he's one of those guys who only comes in like 3 days a week, so it's not like, you know. Anyway, so in the meantime, waiting for my appointment, what's driving me nuts is I just can't stop touching it with my tongue.
Yeah.
That little, that jagged.
It makes you crazy.
Oh, out of my friggin' mind.
I know.
Oh, my God. How are you today?
I'm doing great. Very tired.
Yeah.
Very tired.
The CEO
exhausted.
Of this organization. You're working very hard.
Is fucking exhausted, yes.
Yeah.
Well,
Channel
I don't
2?
Know.
How's Channel 2 rolling?
Channel 2 is rolling just fine. I mean, our traffic has really, really increased since we launched this. But at any rate, next week, this show is going to take a break for a few days.
Okay.
While Susie's still having her fun and I'm trying to regroup and stuff.
Okay, know? That's a good
and,
idea.
Yeah, so I can deliver better radio for everybody.
Yeah, you might as well.
Yeah.
That's a good idea.
So, because I didn't get to rest over the holidays and shit, you know.
I kind of got that feeling. While we were all just totally on hiatus, you were in here doing construction and wiring and building a whole new studio and running shows and keeping the whole. I mean, because there's a 24/7 operation running an internet radio station.
And it now it's double the work.
And you know what? The same, you know, the other thing is too, is it just dawned on me is, you know, there's the same amount of broadcasting going out over our signal here, over our bandwidth, that is going out over any terrestrial broadcast station. And those terrestrial broadcast stations have staffs of many dozens, you know, depending on the size of the station, a couple of hundred. You are it.
Do you think they have that many employees?
Regular radios. Well, I mean, big ones. You know, KFI, and you know, the big ones, the flagship stations. They'll have it. They'll have a good.
You think
but your average radio station, like the stations I would go on, you know, the locals. Yeah. Dozens at least 30, 40 people work at radio stations. Sure.
Yeah, but each radio station has daily shows, and they have probably 4 or 5 programs the whole day, and that's it. Yeah.
Yeah.
So we can offer a lot more programming.
Right.
Yeah.
I'm just saying, is that you're doing the job that, you know, that 30 or 40 people do. So you're working really hard.
It sometimes feels like it, man, let me tell you. But at any rate, nobody cares about that. So you guys are waiting for the baby, and it's coming soon?
We're under 4 weeks. We're like her due date is February 3rd, so Saturday was January 3rd. Mm-hmm. So a month, you know, 4 weeks from Saturday. So you know, we're about 3.5 weeks now. You know, getting there. She goes in. You know, I'll be taking my days. Like, let's see, next week. Monday she's got the baby doctor, and then it's once a week until the baby comes.
Right.
And
now, when you walk around with a pregnant woman, doesn't it make you feel good? Like you're telling the world, you know, I have sex.
Yeah.
And I have a super sperm.
Yes, exactly. I got swimmers, and you're looking at right here. I got Michael Phelps like swimmers in my friggin' nuts. Yeah. It feels good, man. You know, and it's nice to see the attention she gets, and it is cool because I get a certain amount of attention as well. It is cool, man. It is a badge of honor to walk around with that pregnant wife, you know.
Yeah, it is.
and it really is all just so ridiculously special because it's our first, you know. Yeah. And so it's,
but do you see that pregnant women glow? Did you notice that? I mean, it's not just me, right?
No. Yeah. She was glowing.
Yeah.
Now it's kind of like when you have a flashlight and you got to kind of shake it a little bit or you got to tap it. That's her glow now.
I see. Okay.
Up until about 2 weeks ago, it was a bright glow like a lighthouse.
So it's now, sporadic.
Now it's a light. It's a flashlight that you just found in the basement, and you're going tuk tuk tuk. Oh, and a little bit of light. Oh, there it goes again.
Yeah.
Kind of like that. She's really exhausted. She's not, I think over the next 3 weeks, she's definitely going to, you know, all these cliches apply. Everything that you hear about, they all come to fruition. Like, for example, you hear about the women, they hit that ninth month, and they're like, you know, get it out of me. I'm ready to have this baby.
Yeah.
And Andy is not completely there yet. But her girlfriend is, and I'm sure, and I know Lulu, she was in this phase about a week or two ago. Yeah. Andrea's girlfriend is about to have a baby. Andrea and one of her best friends are only 2 weeks apart.
Really?
And her friend went to the doctor and was hoping the doctor would tell her that she's like maybe a centimeter, then maybe she's starting to.
Yeah. Nothing. I know, after 9 months, you're pretty much
she's
ready
done.
For
she's
it.
Like, let's go. Yeah, and Andy is almost there. Like, I just left her just now. She's sitting in the living room. She's trying to find some way to get relief for her back. Her lower back is just fucked right now.
Really?
And so, you know those big Pilates exercise balls? Those big, huge, inflatable?
Uh-huh.
She's sitting on that, and she rocks around on that, and that kind of gives her temporary relief.
Yeah.
And then it cinches up again, and she's got to get on the floor and sit on the hard floor. And then she cannot be comfortable, this poor girl.
Well, sounds depressing.
Anyway. Yeah, so there's your fucking answer. No, she's not glowing.
Thank you very much.
Yeah. No more glow.
We've got two great guests today.
Really?
One is going to be on the phone, and one's going to be in the studio.
Okay, who's coming in?
And quite frankly, I don't remember, but I remember we have
guests. Two great guests.
Yes.
Two great guests, and we're really, really looking forward to whoever the fuck
they will be good, because I only book good guests, so don't worry about it.
It's funny. Quite frankly, I don't know.
Yeah.
You don't remember either of them?
No, well, yeah. In fact, the one that's calling wrote a book, and this is a story about abuse and things like that.
Oh, good. More happy stuff.
More happy stuff.
Awesome.
But it sounds pretty interesting. Mm-hmm. It has something to do with the Hamptons, you know?
Oh.
So I think this is like rich people and stuff.
Uh-huh.
You know, that sort of thing. So that sounds pretty interesting.
Very cool.
And then the one that's coming in, if I'm remembering correctly, probably like a life coach or something. That's pretty much everybody out there today is a life coach.
Yeah, it seems like a lot of people hanging that shingle outside, you know, that they're a life coach.
So it's sort of like, I know how to live, now let me teach you.
Which
I was at a point like that one time in my life, you know. I went studied the Kabbalah and everything, and I had like answers for everything, you know. So I'm like, I should be out there spreading this to the world, you know. So that's what they're doing.
Wow.
You know? Now instead I talk shit on the radio.
There you go.
Yeah.
That's it.
You don't learn how to live here, let me tell you.
Actually, no, you do. What are you kidding? You do.
Do you?
Sure. Listening to your show, that's absolutely people learn how to live. They listen. Between you and Susie, you know. I mean, Susie was she lives a way that I could never live.
Yeah.
I just couldn't live by the seat of my pants like that. And she really enjoys it.
You need the security, right?
I need the routine.
Predictability.
Yeah.
Yes. Yes.
I could not couch
but
surf.
But we're older too, you know. I mean,
like,
you know
when I was 18, I could never do that.
Really?
When I was 20, I was not lying. I couldn't do that. Now, I was a bit of a vagabond. Right. By the time I was 21, I was out working the road.
Yeah.
Me in my little car and just driving all over America, doing one nighters and weekends around the country. Yeah, I've been in every state except
Hawaii.
Almost
like a cliche, huh? I mean,
very
you know,
much a cliche. Yeah, a very vaudevillian vagabond type of thing. And yeah. I mean, I had these were all dates that were booked for me. I mean, you know, I had a calendar full, but I was routed. I've literally performed in every state except Hawaii.
I know you've said that. That's amazing.
49
you know
states, and except for Alaska, I've been
then
in all of them by
go
car.
To Hawaii and make it 50.
I know. That's next. I've got to do that. And but even then when I was in my most vagabond phase, I was always in hotels and I had my own room and I never shared a hotel room and I was I ate
like
in
the
restaurants.
Right?
I mean
that's
there's a certain comfort level, you know. Yeah. And now it's like now if I fly internationally, I got to upgrade. I've got to sit in business class. I can't fly coach.
Wow.
Oh, it's the ultimate spoil. You just can't fly. Yeah. No. But anyway, you know. I think listening to your show can be inspirational for people who want to live a little bit. And plus, I think when people listen to your show, they're also looking for a vicarious experience.
That's true. That's true too. You know. Plus, we talk about so many different things. Which, you know, I wanted to get to the Middle East for a moment, if you don't mind. You know,
never mind.
Because this is. You know, because I think about it, you know, like, you know, for a year I've been sitting here, I've had a radio show, and I never really talked about Israel or anything like this, you know, but now it's in the news and stuff, you know, and it really bothers me to keep seeing the same reaction from the world, you know, and you know, so I posted something on Facebook too. If you're on Facebook, you can go to my page, there's a link there. But it doesn't matter. I mean, I'm just saying this for people who want to go later and check it out. But it's sort of like a flash presentation, and it gives you the history in a nutshell of. You know, of the Jews, of modern Israel and what's going on and how it's not about land. Like I've always said, it's about hatred, you know?
Yes.
And when it's about hatred, you're never going to solve that problem. You know, they're bent on destroying the Jews, pushing them to the sea, and they won't stop at that. They were offered their own state twice. 1948 and in 2000.
Yep.
They did not want it.
No,
because
they walked away.
It's not about their state.
No, you know. No, it's not about the state. It's about hatred. It's about the word infidel. It's about Zionism and all that other stuff that they claim. And it's also what it really is very much about is because, you know, you got to figure there's a lot of clean slates out there. There's a lot of mushy heads out there that really they're like sheep. They'll believe what they hear or see the most.
Yeah.
That's human nature. I'm not necessarily indicting those people.
Yeah.
But
and the majority of the population is probably illiterate anyway, so they just kind of follow.
Right, and
you know?
So
I mean, I'm not being condescending.
No,
it's just that that's the reality.
It's
when you live in those kind of regimes,
and
you know.
And but I'm saying I'm talking about those here in America.
Right.
My problem is that you know what is what you what it is. It's a symptom of this of the mainstream media being so unbelievably. Pro-Palestinian because, listen, first of all, anti-Semitism is fashionable. Mm-hmm. Anti-Semitism is in, baby. You know, I mean, they hold up the United... It's amazing to me how people hold up the United Nations in such esteem. Mm-hmm. The United Nations is made up, and I was talking about this yesterday. I'd love to actually, if I really was committed, I'd be doing a little bit of research and getting some percentages here. But the number of anti-Semitic, Islamic... And other whatever nations that are make up the United Nations, it's mind-boggling to me that Israel even participates in the United Nations.
I think they're
there out of respect
for us.
They're
allowed to.
Yeah, it's, I think that each of us sit there and go, "Hey, if I've got to be there, you got to be there." You know, it's I don't want to be. Well, you, I've got to be there, so you better be there too. If I got to go to the, you better go. You know, it's like going on dates with like you know a couple of ugly chicks. It's like, hey man, you better fucking show up for this fucking date. Anyway, I just think that the people in America are subjected to this liberal media that is pro-Palestinian and anti-Israeli. Right. And
I think they're just pro, like, the so-called victim, and they portray... You see, what used to happen is the Jews were viewed as David. Now Israel is viewed as the Goliath, you know?
Right.
And that's
because
a problem.
Because the media's painted that picture.
Yes, yes. And that's unfortunate, you know?
It
because
is.
It's still about survival, and people don't understand
people
that.
People have to keep... And you know what? Look. It's like I said, you know, what's really frustrating is... I try to think... Maybe you can tell me. I wonder if you can think of... Because I can't. Think of the last time that I saw the images of September 11th.
Right.
I'm trying to think of the last time I remember seeing that on television for some reason. Similarly, you know, Israel needs to beat the drum of what it was founded for, what it was founded about. It was founded after World War II, after the Holocaust, in the middle of the Soviet Union. And all of the, I remember seeing the Soviet Jews getting off the plane. I remember as a little kid in the 70s, early 80s, seeing those Soviet Jews coming off that plane in Israel, finally being allowed to go from Russia, from Soviet Union. I remember that. And I didn't know quite exactly what was going on, but I remember my mom and dad saying they were, like, you know, not allowed to practice their religion.
Yeah, and they were not allowed to leave either.
And they were not allowed to leave. Until, and I remember that. And, you know, so Israel needs to beat that drum once again and play those images and say, this is what our nation is in response to.
Right.
This is why we exist. Never again.
Right.
And we are surrounded by people. Look, listen, if Israel was really smart, they'd relocate everything to, like, Utah and Montana.
There you go. Or Uganda. That's where they were going. That's where the Arabs want us to go.
It's like, you know, I mean, really, honestly, it's but now at this point, of course, that would be defeat, and there's no way you defeat. And plus, it's just a beautiful nation, which, again, I haven't been there yet. But anyway, the whole thing is that the world needs to be reminded of the principles and that Israel was founded upon. You know, the reasons why and that's that. Never again. Never, ever again. And and they're surrounded by people that if given the chance, given the opportunity, even those relatively civilized Jordanians at all, they would in a minute build a whole new set of ovens. And, you know, but, you know, even that would be too humane for these motherfuckers.
Yeah.
These are the kind of people who want to blow you up and then drag your entrails, you know, through the city and show them to your children.
Yeah.
That's these sick motherfuckers are Nazis. I know.
Yes.
They are Nazis times 10.
Mm-hmm.
So so actually the gas chamber would be a humane choice compared to what it is that they do.
Yeah. And if you listen to the rhetoric, you realize that the Arabs really want to finish what Hitler has started, and that is the final solution.
Right.
You know? And that never again reminds me of a song that I want to play, and the hell with royalty or anything, okay? Mm. But we really have to play that. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to put a quick song so I can transfer the song over to this computer and we'll play it, okay?
All right, excellent.
But I think it's a powerful song and we have to play it. So stay with us for just a second and we'll be back right after this.
Don't go anywhere.
There's something about the way you try to look. It's getting right to me, deeper than it really should. What are you, an angel, or just looking that good? When you take your time, you are so divine. I'm not surprised, I'd like to watch you in this light.
Okay, so we're back, and you know, I have to play this song for you because this was played to me, and I remember the story behind this. I was visiting Toronto a few years ago, some friends and stuff.
Okay.
And then we went to someone's house, and he just says, I want you to listen to a song. You know, don't say anything, just kind of sit back and listen. And I did, and this thing was like so powerful that it really shook me. And so I want to play it for you. It's called, well, you know what? I won't tell you what it's called. Let's just play.
Okay, excellent.
To all those racist colors and creeds, every man. numerous victims and all their families of the murdered, tortured, enslaved, raped, robbed, and persecuted. Never again. To the men, women, and children who died in their struggle to live, never to be forgotten. Reuven ben Menachem, yeah. My own blood dragged through the mud, perished in my heart, still cherished and loved. Stripped of our pride, everything we lived for, families cried. There's nowhere to run to, nowhere to hide. Tossed to the side, access denied. 6 million died for what? Yo, a man shot dead in his back. Helpless women and children under constant attack. For no reason till the next season, and we still bleeding. Yo, it's freezing, and men burning hell, some for squeezing. No hope for a remedy, nothing to believe. Moving targets who walk with the star in their sleeve. Forever marked with a number, tattooed to your body. Late night, eyes closed, clutched to my shoddy. Having visions, flashes of death camps and prisons. No provisions, deceived by the devil's decisions. Forced into a slave, death before dishonor. For those men who were brain shot and sent to their grave. Can't awaken, it's too late, everything's been taken. I'm shaking, family, history, the making. Never again shall we march like sheep to the slaughter. Never again shall we sit and take orders. Stripped of our culture, robbed of our names. Stripped of our freedom and thrown into the flames. Forced from our families, taken from our homes. Fought from our God, then burned of our bones. Never again shall we march like sheep to the slaughter. Never again leave our sons and daughters. Stripped of our culture, robbed of our names. Stripped of our freedom and thrown into the flames. Forced from our families, taken from our homes. Fought from our God and everything we own. Never again. Some fled through the rumors of wars, but most left for dead. Few escaped to the shores with just one loaf of bread. Banished, called in for questioning and vanished, never to be seen again. I can't express the pain that was felt in the train to Auschwitz. Tears poured down like rain. Naked, face to face with the master race. Hatred, blood of David. My heart belongs to God and stays sacred. Rabbis and priests, disabled individuals, the poor, the scholars, all labeled common criminals. Mass extermination, total annihilation. Shipped into the ghetto and prepared for liquidation. Tortured and starved, innocent experiments stripped down and carved up or gassed to death. The last hour, I smell the flowers. Flashbacks of family then sent to the showers. Powerless, undressed, women with babies clung tight to their chest, crying. Who were the guests dying? Another life lost, count the cost. Another body gas burned and tossed in the Holocaust. Never again shall we march like sheep to the slaughter. Never again leave our sons and daughters. Stripped of our culture, robbed of our names. Raped of our freedom and thrown into the flames. Never again from our families, taken from our homes. Never again from our God and everything we own. Never again shall we march like sheep to the slaughter. Never again shall we sit and take orders. Stripped of our culture, robbed of our names. Never again of our freedom and thrown into the flames. Never again from our families, taken from our homes. Never again from our God and burned of our bones. Never again, never again. Never again. Never again. The final solution is now retribution. Remedy, Wu-Tang.
Okay.
Ah.
What do you think of that?
Very powerful.
Pretty heavy stuff, huh?
Yeah. God damn it.
Yeah, I know.
It wasn't doing it, by the way, a couple minutes ago. Yeah, very powerful. Do we know the name of that artist?
This is a group called Wu-Tang, the Wu-Tang Clan.
Wait, that's Wu-Tang Clan?
Yes.
They're coloreds.
Yes.
They're black guys.
Yes.
They're Schwarzes.
Someone told me the story.
Schwarzes are telling a story about the Jews and Never yeah. Again and marching.
I think there was a story behind this. And
Schwarzes.
I think well, these people have said some Jews, anti-Semitic things. Well, so it's because they wanted to make up for it.
And you know what? Mm. They figured, you know what? We got a bunch of Hebes running our lives here. Mm. We got our lawyers and our accountants. Let's do a solid.
Yeah.
Let us Schwarzes do something for these Jews that are taking care of us. Mm-hmm. You know. I'm sure, what's his name? Old Dirty Bastard from Wu-Tang Clan. I'm sure he had a bullet removed by some Jew doctor at some point in his life. And he figures, you know, I'm going to write a rap. That so yeah, so Schwarz is for Jews. That's nice.
Yeah. Regardless, though,
I was just looking to see how many times I could say Schwarz.
Yeah, I just thought it was a neat approach
that's
to this
amazing.
Because
yeah,
you know, maybe it'll appeal to younger people too.
Absolutely,
you know?
Especially because with that
like rap music
that underlying that beat with the
that's the national anthem. That's the Israeli national anthem.
That's the Israeli
that's
national
what it
anthem.
Is, yes, and then in the end he says Shema Israel, which is the prayer that you would say, let's say, before you die or mm-hmm. something, you know. And,
wow.
Yeah. So it's very deep, very powerful, you know. And when you live in Israel, you're reminded of this every year on the day of remembrance of the Holocaust. And, you know, when you grow up as a child and you see all these things, you know, being marched to the ovens and stuff, it stays with you. You know, and so, you know, in this modern day and age that people won't see that this thing is about to be repeated. Oh, let's say it'll never be repeated, not with the state of Israel there, but
right.
but the attempt is there, you know, and the thinking behind it is.
Well, the thing is, you know, but you know, I'm one. You said it would never be repeated because the state of Israel is there.
Right.
You know, I'll be honest with you. I'm wondering how much. Until Israel feels that they can take the gloves off,
mm-hmm.
they can take those handcuffs off. Until America takes the handcuffs off of Israel, I feel like it happens every time another bunch of rockets is launched from Hamas. I think every time a Hamas leader is elected to an office, it's like they're taking a little bit more, and it's a yeah. little bit more, and it's a little bit more.
Quote unquote the, elected for
well, quote unquote yeah.
yes.
And you know, so it's. I think it still is happening. I think it's still happening. To be honest, I think every time an American votes for a politician who is not pro-Israel, then you know, never again is not fully in force.
Yeah.
It's not a fully enforced policy. Never again, if, you know. And you know, it's always a conundrum to me. It's fascinating to me to think that the like a voting bloc that the Jewish vote in America is so consistently Democrat and so consistently liberal. Because if you want to find supporters of Palestine, go to the liberal Democrats.
Yeah.
And it's amazing to me how many Jews how they consider that Gold Coast of Florida. You know, the where I used to live, Boca Raton and Fort Lauderdale and all of that area down there, Miami. Man, I mean, it's Jew Central, and they are just a solid voting block for the left.
Yes.
And the left is not a friend of Israel on the whole, in general.
Yeah.
You know, and to be quite honest, we'll just say.
Yeah, I don't know about that, though. I mean, because I don't know. I've seen, don't give me Carter for an example, okay? But let's say, you know, John Kennedy was a friend, you know.
Different, it's a different Democrat party from 63, brother.
Mm.
It's a whole different thing, because back then it was still a nasty word to be a communist. I'd love to.
What about Clinton, though? I mean, Clinton was a pretty good supporter.
He was
think.
A good supporter of Israel. Well, that's because you know what? That's the thing too. Is that listen again? We're talking about the greatest politician to ever live. The guy doing what he did, putting us in the position he put us in. By the time, listen, September 11th had Bill Clinton written all over it. All
don't get started
policy.
With that, well, thing, no. man. I don't see that. You know, you can't blame the victim. You know what I'm saying? You can't blame the victim. We're the ones that got bombed. Yes, you know, maybe we should have had better intelligence and shit, but we were never prepared for this. Just like Pearl Harbor, we never thought they would do it.
Right, but you just said, yeah, we had bad intelligence. That's Clinton. You can't say, yeah, we have bad intelligence, but don't blame Clinton. Bush had been in office for like 9 months.
Mm-hmm.
Bush had been in office for 9 months. Bill Clinton had been there for 8 years.
Right.
You know, the guy had his chances. Anyway, the point is, we're not going to get into all that. The point is, though, is that when you say, what about Clinton? Clinton was a brilliant politician, the greatest of all time.
Really?
No, I mean,
you really respect him that much.
I respect his political... Listen, the guy lied under oath. I'm not even going to talk about the blowjob. The blowjob is whatever. The blowjob just shows what a piece of shit he is. Okay, that's just character. But the other part of it is he lied under oath. He is the most powerful man in the world who is supposed to be looked up to by little kids in kindergarten. And he sat there while a citizen of the United States, he obstructed her justice. He obstructed her pursuit of justice against him for sexual harassment. And he lied under oath, something that you and I would be up the river for. This guy did that and numerous other things that just spoke of his lousy character, and he is held up in such esteem. Only the most brilliant politician ever could have done what he did. Yeah. You know what I mean? So anyway, the point is that I think that if you – listen, Bill Clinton protested against America when he was a kid in England. You know what I mean? He protested against his own nation on foreign soil while we were at war. This is the kind of guy –
what were they protesting? The war?
The Vietnam War, yeah.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. And so anyway, so the point is that, you know, sure, I of course he's gonna be out there and front and center, appearing to be for Israel, but I really believe that that if you scratch deep enough, you're going to find a Palestinian supporter there. That's the way he is. I really do. I really think that.
I doubt it strongly, but you know, I mean, what are you going to say?
But I think if Israel was severely attacked and it came down to it, like let's say if Israel wanted to was looking for support for a strike at Iran, mm-hmm. I think you'd find a much quicker yes from a Republican than you would from listen, we're about to find out. I'm all ready to go with Barack. He's my president. I'm behind him 100%, and I'm hoping and I'm waiting and I'm seeing. But you know what, the first time that this guy, if he in fact, how would you feel if Barack Obama, because I know you're an Obama guy,
not an Obama guy. I just was not a McCain guy.
Right.
Okay.
Right. But you were also a Hillary guy.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
But I'm saying is that, you know, is that I wonder how are you going to feel as a Barack guy? Mm-hmm. How are you going to feel if he does in fact actually sit down with a guy like Ahmadinejad?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I don't know.
See, now that's what scares me. There's people in this world, friends of mine, who say, that would be the most wonderful thing. It would show the world that we're willing to talk.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I'm like, but you don't talk with these people. They don't understand.
They don't understand
talking.
Mahmoud Ahmadinejad wakes up in the morning with the taste of Jewish blood on his fucking tongue. Sick motherfucker.
Or at least the fantasy of it, yeah.
Yeah.
You're right. Well, we'll see. I just think that Obama is really going to be extra cautious in, you know, because people are already criticizing him or afraid of him for having Islamic background or whatever it is, you know, an Islamic middle name, whatever. But so I think he's going to be careful in the things that he does.
Well, he'll be cautious, yeah.
Yeah.
Sure. Because he's been accused of all these things, you know. Yeah.
Plus I got to tell you that as a nation, the United States has always been behind Israel. You know?
Yes,
so, so that's why I'm saying that it doesn't really matter what the president says, but the Congress is always pro-Israel, and or for the most part. Mm-hmm. And so who knows? But I think he's under like a microscope.
I have a hard time, admittedly, I have a hard time separating. You know, I fall into that guilty by association category where, you know, I put that Hugo Chavez in the same group as Ahmadinejad. And there are so many guys, so many politicians in Congress, so many show business celebrities who embrace a guy like Hugo Chavez.
Yeah.
And as far as I'm concerned, if you're embracing him, you're embracing Ahmadinejad. These are two guys that stood there at the United Nations and disparaged our president, you know, in New York City.
Yeah.
That's another thing. Oh, man.
Yeah, they have no problem with that at all.
Yeah, and so, you know, it's like, you know, if you love one, you love the other, you know, they're all in the same bunch. And if Hugo Chavez could wipe us off the map, and that's another thing too, man, we may very well be starting to experience kind of what it's like to be Israel, because what was going on over the last 2 months, there were naval war games going on off the coast of Venezuela with Russian warships participating with the Venezuelan Navy. We've got a new and enthusiastic bunch in Cuba, and you know, it's like, man, I tell you, just south of our in our own hemisphere here, and just south of us, there is a whole lot of anti-American sentiment with a whole lot of oil money whole lot of backing.
A lot of people don't like us. You know, let me take this call.
Yeah.
Good morning. You're on the air with Sam and TJ. Who's on the line?
Hi there. It's Krista Jan Ryan calling from the snowy Berkshires.
Yes. How you doing?
I used to work in Pitts. I used to work do comedy in Pittsfield.
Oh, you know what that is?
The Berkshires. Yeah. Really? Yeah.
It's the Pitts.
Ah, yes. The All Seasons Inn. I remember these things. It's called the All Seasons Inn in Pittsfield.
I wonder if it's still open.
Yeah.
So you're an East Coast kind of girl.
Yeah, it's actually, I just got done doing a 30-year stint down in the fabulous Hamptons.
A 30-year stint? Wow, that's a long time.
A 30-year stint as a landscape designer to the upper 2% of Manhattan in the world. Of the, you know, the wealthiest, you know what they are. The wealthiest people of, you know, Manhattan in the world as a landscape designer.
Oh, wow. So so you wrote a book. What's the name of the book?
Silent Screams from the Hamptons.
Silent Screams from the Hamptons.
From the Hamptons.
Yes. Hmm. So tell us a little bit about this. I mean, you wrote me a little bit about it, and it was fascinating. You've obviously got a story to tell, and you put it down on paper. So were you always wealthy, or did you marry into wealth? How did you end up in the Hamptons?
How did I end up in the Hamptons in 2 minutes or less?
No, you've got plenty of time. Go ahead.
I ended up down there. You know, my sister had lived down there before she moved to Boston, and I was very attracted to the area because of the ocean and because of the beautiful, you know, the seascape of what the ocean had offered. And I was born and raised in Kingston, New York, which is up on the Hudson River.
Oh, yeah. It's up just past Poughkeepsie.
Right across from Pittsfield.
Yeah.
Yeah, so I ended up down there, and then of course, you know, I'm actually part American Indian, so mm-hmm. I love the outdoors and rock climbing and kayaking and canoeing, and of course my father would continue to say to me, how are you going to earn a living doing that?
Yeah.
And of course gradually moved into, I started my own little gardening career by the time I was 11. I was doing gardening services for my aunt in uptown Kingston, and by the time I was 12, I had 10 clients.
Mm-hmm. Wow, that's amazing.
So I just kind of moved the whole entrepreneurship down to the eastern end of Long Island, and that's where I met my ex, who was running a landscaping business out in the Hamptons, a TV show, a radio show, a chimney sweeping business. You know, he was quite the entrepreneur out there.
Right. So that appealed to you?
Making money?
Or marrying into money.
Making a lot of money?
Yeah.
In a very wealthy area, working outside? Sure. Why wouldn't it be?
You would take that, yes. How old were you at the time when you met your ex-husband?
28.
So you've been around the block a couple times and stuff, and you probably knew what you were doing, or do you feel you were too young?
No, I knew the basic. I knew the basics for, you know, gardening and landscaping. You know, mm-hmm. plant the root side down,
right.
And so I knew the basics. But of course, you know, working out in the Hamptons was a whole, other entity as far as, you know, providing services for people who would read Architectural Digest in January, come out with the cover and say, I want this week, I want this year. And then, of course, you'd have this flurry of activity because, you know, it was all about performance.
Right. Wow. So
I have a question, if
yes.
It's okay. Sorry. Krista, what is exactly the disease of the family of origin?
It is the generational inheritance that we pass on, which can be alcoholism, mm-hmm. anger, rage, codependency, you know, all of the bondages that keep us in the flesh-like form of habitual addictions that get passed on, incest.
Mm-hmm.
Incest is a big one. It's interesting because when I went in, and I know you didn't get a chance to read the book, when I went in to be treated, I had been raped as a, 11 years old by a school teacher.
Wow. Wait a minute. 11 years old? Where were you living at the time?
In Kingston.
And you had a teacher now 11 years old is what? It's elementary school still?
Yeah.
And
it was seventh grade.
Seventh grade. So that's middle school.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Yeah, middle school.
Jesus.
They say that the average child has sex before 12 years old.
What?
Yeah, these days. Yeah.
Wow. I mean, I have two boys. I have to tell you, if there was a girl in the household, I would be a mess.
Yeah, I can imagine. I mean, it's really scary. So
you were raped at 11 by a school teacher.
How did that happen? I mean, did he take you home? Was it at school? What happened?
No. I'm a skier. I'm an athlete. And I was a very, you know, my mother was a phys ed teacher, coach, instructor, who actually, she chose to coach the very, you know, lower side of Kingston, where there was a big black community, because she knew, hands down, that the blacks had it over us athletically. You know, they were just physically groomed differently. They had, you know, physical attributes that made them much more professional. And so, of course, I was always challenged, always excelled, always pushed to be an athlete. And by the time I was in seventh grade, I was, in triathlons and marathons and this thon and that thon. And I was skiing, you know, very, right. You know, a lot. By the time I was 10, I would say I was probably hitting most of the intermediate to expert slopes. So we went on a school trip, and this guy had just entered the school system. And, of course, I'm, you know, hot shot show off. And I'm zipping down and, you know, lightening up the trails. And, of course, this guy's really impressed.
Mm-hmm.
So he is just a new beginner, and he wants me to show him my stuff. And, of course, one thing led to another.
Mm-hmm.
And by about the second ski trip, he is asking me, can we go off on a separate ski trip? And, of course, at that point, my parents are bombed out on Valium and Scotch and, you know, whatever they were doing at the time, beating the crap out of each
other. What a place to grow up.
Sure, why not? Pick me up at 4 a.m. Nobody's up at that time. They're still in their blackout. He drives up with his little Fiat, and we put our skis in the car, and off we go up to Vermont.
Yeah.
Did you have
hippie parents and stuff? I mean...
Excuse me?
Hippie parents?
No, I mean, my father was a pilot and my mother was a phys ed teacher.
Really? They were taking all these drugs.
Well, during the 1960s, they were passing out Valium like you and ate candy canes.
Right.
You know, don't forget, well, if you had read, not that I'm questioning you, but, you know, I had triplet sisters who were born with cerebral palsy.
Yeah, I just saw that here. You had there triplet. Now, that alone must have caused such angst between your parents, the idea, there had to be just simply probably a very ignorant version of a blame game going on between the two of them. I mean, had to be such resentment at one or the other at any given moment for the three girls.
I just think it was an overwhelming burden of just displaced, really displaced energy of what needed to happen and when. So you have six children, triplets with cerebral palsy who needed a lot of help, a lot of direction, a lot of therapy. Two parents, full-time, needed to earn money. And, of course, the burden of running the household was overwhelming.
Right.
And my mother, who was a control freak, and my father, who was very laid-back, you know, easygoing guy. I mean, he couldn't even comprehend how much was, you know, needed to really run the show. It was a huge show to run.
Right. So now the abuse that you talk about, obviously, are you talking about later in life as well as when you were a child?
Abuse what?
Abuse. I don't know. You talked about abuse and stuff. Did you go through physical abuse?
Growing up and watching it.
I'm sorry?
Growing up and watching it. You know, my parents would get drunk and they would, you know, fight over the checkbook. Who wasn't doing what? What wasn't happening? You know, it was poor things. God bless them. Their teeth fell out by the time they were 40 from the stress.
Wow.
You know, what I find fascinating is all of my life and all of my reading, I had never actually come across that term, the disease of the family of origin. Now, at the risk of sounding awfully ignorant, did you coin that phrase, did that somehow get past me? Because that's a fascinating term.
It's the family of origin. So, mm-hmm. So you look at the family of origin.
Right.
That's the claim. Okay. Yeah. And with each family, I don't care. I don't care what. You know, where you came from, you inherit some baggage, period.
Yeah, and you know, and for some families, it's simply decorum. For some families, there doesn't have to be any actual addiction, doesn't have to be any actual, I like to break down the word disease sometimes and actually pronounce it dis-ease, and for some families, it could simply be just screaming and shouting.
Right, anger, rage.
Yeah.
But you talk about the family of decorum. Mm-hmm. What is that family's roots from? There must have been a high level of shame somewhere that they have to maintain this facade of absolute, you know, the perfect image. You know, that there is no fault, not, you know, perfection.
Right.
You know, as we look at perfection, you know, what that stacks up. Mm-hmm. You know, the inability to make mistakes, the inability to call your own stuff, the inability of being able to, you know, understand that, you know, it's not a perfect world. So why even aspire to it?
Right. And sometimes I would think it could also be cultural. I think you've got these alpha male-centric type of cultural situations and the opposite, you know, we know that where the mom is the dominant one. Just it could be any one of a contributing any one of a number of contributing
Absolutely.
Factors. And so
just you look at what the grooming material was. Just look at the grooming material, and you pretty much can it pretty much lays itself out.
Yeah, and so now the name of the novel is Silent Screams from the Hamptons. By the time you got to the Hamptons, you had already experienced your own recovery to a certain degree. Correct.
What do you call recovery?
I mean, you had already decided that you were going to, you know, I think how it put here, you had already sorted through your past and looked at all the episodes that contributed to the chaos of your adult life. I just going by the timeline, I didn't know if by the time you had gotten to the Hamptons and started with the landscaping, if you had already started to reconcile some of these things.
No, I pretty much carried the baggage all the way through.
Mm-hmm. So wait, did you think recovery was a bad choice of words, or?
Well, recovery in a sense that I left the I pretty much delineated myself between my family and myself and chose to just go off and live my life.
Right.
But at that time, I didn't realize how much the inheritance was of what I was carrying around, and then just continued to place it into this next major altering relationship.
Right.
Like the big one. You know, this was the big one. This was the big marriage. I stayed in it for 25 years.
What? Now, you've got the two boys. On a daily basis, do you find yourself still fighting off this disease of the family of origin? Do you find yourself, in a constant, staying one step ahead of the old behavior?
Minute by minute.
Mm-hmm.
Is that a song?
Now, without, because there's a lot of anonymity out there, without getting specific about different programs, have you participated in any type of 12-step programs out there? If you want to,
here's the opening line of my stand-up comic act. They should have taken me from the birthing room to the recovery room. And if there's a 12-step program out there, I should be in it. Anything, you name it, I'm there.
Yeah. Well, it sounds like you've had a very interesting life, and you never did send us the book. Maybe you can send one copy for us.
Absolutely, I'd love to. And there's actually Pittsfield Time Warner actually did a. I was amazed they did a whole hour on me.
Nice, nice. Can people find that online?
You could. I could actually mail you the disc, or I could have you walk through how to access it. It's Be Mile, Passion of Compassion was our show, and it's Smile with Be Mile, and it's PBS up there? PBS.
Uh-huh.
And you go there, and online they have all of the Comcasts already loaded.
Nice. Well, okay, so that was Silent Cries from the Hamptons.
Silent Screams.
Silent Screams from the Hamptons, I'm sorry. And what is your full name again?
My name is Krista Jan Ryan.
Okay, great.
And are you still? And where are you now? By the way, are you in the Hamptons still? Are you out on the East End?
No, I'm actually. Well, I'm there. We're just releasing the book down there, and there's a couple of NPR stations that have picked me up, and we're going to do a whole big release down there in February.
Great.
Right now, I'm actually up in the Berkshires full time.
Oh, that's right.
I opened up a store.
Nice.
And this whole end deal with this book has it's a full time job between what I'm doing right now, which is. I'm working with fundraisers right now with, domestic retreats, domestic violence centers, And what's happening now is I've gained two other people, and we're going out as a gig. Mm-hmm. And one of the women who just cut an album, her name is Robin O'Haron, and mm-hmm. she does gospel and blues in a form that would blow your mind.
Hmm.
And then I've actually also saddled up with Dennis Watlington. Mm-hmm. And Dennis Watlington is a screenplay, screenwriter, and book writer. He just won an award in the Hampton Film Festival for his film on Twin Lenses. So the three of us are going out and actually working a lot of these fundraisers together. And he stands up very highly on civil rights, because
mm-hmm.
his book states clearly, from the ghetto, from the gutter of the ghetto of Harlem
mm-hmm.
to becoming a Hotchkiss full-time scholarship.
Wow. Wow. Fascinating.
Crystal Ryan, thank you so much. Thank you so much.
Okay.
For do you want to give us a link where people can find out more about this?
Yeah, where can people find Silent Screams from the Hamptons?
Okay, go on www.CrystaJanRyan.com, and you'll find all of my books, the screenplays that I've got going out there, that and some TV promotions that I'm working on trying to get there with a lot of the stuff that I'm working on. And if you go there, you'll see my gardening, you'll see the store, and then go right to books, and then you can email me directly, and then you can get any of those books or anything that you're interested in, and you know, that's where I am.
Sounds
fantastic.
Great. Sounds great. Okay, thank you so much, and all the best to you. Good luck with the book.
Okay, thanks.
Okay, thank
Bye,
you.
Krista.
Bye.
All right, we're going to take a quick break, and we'll be back right after this.
Oval Office Errors, a tiny little division of Hallmark, introduces Bushism Talking Greeting Cards. They're great for every occasion, like graduation.
As yesterday's positive report card shows, children do learn.
Patriotic holidays.
Our enemies never stop thinking about new ways to harm our country and our people. And neither do we.
And Earth Day.
I know the human being and fish can coexist peacefully.
Bushism Talking Greeting Cards even has something for religious holidays.
I couldn't imagine somebody like Osama bin Laden understanding the joy of Hanukkah.
Bushism Talking Greeting Cards. When you care enough to send a card that fumbles over words just like the president.
Irreverent, entertaining, cool. You are listening to LA Talk Radio. We say what we want.
He tried to tell her, and she thought it right. Hand in hand, they marched on through the night. He knew the answers she'd hoped to find. It'll just take a little time, just a little bit of time. It wasn't easy, but how could they fail? Though love can blind you just like a veil. He knew the price was worth the strain. There was so very much to gain. So much love was there to gain. And they flew so high that they lifted off the ground. They locked themselves away in the magic day.
My name is Rachel, and my telephone number is... I wanted to tell you that you're evil, horrible people. You're awful people. You represent horrible ideas. God hates you, and he wants to kill your children. You should all burn in hell. Bye.
In a world where shitty talk radio proliferates the internet, two people have teamed up to save the world. It's Sam and Susie in the morning, right here on LA Talk Radio.
Okay, and we're back in the studio with TJ.
Yes, we are. Hello.
So what's going on in the news? Anything?
Let's see. I tell you one thing is really starting to get. I was just reading in the paper this morning because I'm trying to grow up real fast and make my life like a TV show where, I get the paper delivered in the morning. I go outside. I come back from my run.
White picket fence.
I literally have a white picket fence.
Really?
Yeah, isn't that funny? And God's given me a lot of blessings in the last couple of years.
Would you consider your life? Did you have a hard life?
Only when I made it hard.
Really?
Yeah. Only when I made it hard. My life.
Circumstances have been fine with you. I mean, it's just the way you reacted to them. Maybe.
Five kids. Mom and dad still together to this day.
Mm-hmm.
No untimely deaths. No abuse of any kind. There's emotional. There's, of course, every family is dysfunctional. Every family is dysfunctional. It's just, some are sicker than others. And the dysfunction in my family was, a little more than a whole lot of bad communication from time to time.
Yeah.
But I've had an unbelievably easy life.
Mm.
And it could have been a whole lot easier if I had simply,
gotten out of your own way, maybe.
If I had just relaxed and this is one way my parents could have helped me. They could have helped me to understand the idea that there are a lot of things that I have no control over.
Yes.
If I had been able to relax a little bit more in my life and breathe a little bit, mm-hmm. if my parents had seen that they had a high strung, success driven kid,
right.
If my parents had seen that and then done something about it, I think I might be a little bit better off. I mm-hmm. might have had a little bit more success or whatever. And considering the success I've had has been monumental. I mean, the things I've done as a comedian, I've done things that 90% of comedians who start off, do that first amateur night mm-hmm. with dreams and aspirations, they never get to where I've been. Ever.
Really?
I'm not even close, the things I've done. And yeah.
Did you get a lot of sex on the road?
Just like my life. Yeah, if I didn't fuck it up. Yeah, if I the sex that happened in spite of me, yeah. probably. And I may have mentioned this here before. I was always so reticent. I was so concerned about offending and doing the wrong thing that I was just happy to jerk off.
Yeah.
I was happy to just have some girl show me a tits and I just sit there and just throw one at her,
Why is that? Did you have like a performance anxiety?
No. I didn't want to offend. I didn't want to do the wrong thing.
Yeah. I know. I used to be like that.
No,
too.
Yeah, no. I was able to get plenty of girls back to the room. I was in colleges. Oh my god, when
I used to
work colleges,
fuck up like that too. You don't want to offend. You think they don't want it.
But here's the thing, Here's the thing, though. Right? Is that in the end, though, I was always able to come.
Mm-hmm.
I always threw a load.
Very important.
Never had to worry about anybody being pregnant.
Yeah.
Never had to worry about I'll tell you the funkiest freaking story, right?
Mm-hmm.
Working in Oklahoma, working colleges.
Mm-hmm.
I was doing colleges. There was one stretch in my career where I did 350 colleges in 2 years, over four semesters.
Wow,
350.
That's a lot. Jeez.
Okay, and that's what
that's
the entire,
probably every college in the country.
I did. That's when I did the crisscross of America. So we're in Oklahoma. It's me and two other comics, and we're in Oklahoma, and it was Enid, Oklahoma, and Sayre, Oklahoma, two places that I know you have never heard of.
Never heard of.
And met this one girl. And we were hanging out after the show, and she was really amorous and really, the whole stars in her eyes thing. Plus the idea that I was from New York. Now, this carried over to when I told the times that I worked nightclubs around the country as well. If you're in Nebraska, you're from New York, and like It's just rare that you go into a gas station, you're at a Circle K in Kearney, Nebraska. It's rare that a New Yorker walks in and says, "Hey, how are you? Good morning." You know what I mean? It's weird. So they go, "Wow, where are you from? I mean, you're exotic."
Really?
Let alone working, being a comedian in a college in Enid, Oklahoma, at a community college, right?
Yeah.
So this girl's got stars in her eyes. She's treating me like I'm Johnny fucking Carson. And yeah, I might as well be, you know, George Carlin standing there in front of her. And we end up kind of hanging out. She comes back to my hotel, right? And didn't bang her. Didn't, no sex. Just a little bit of touchy feely, little bit of rubby rubby, and blah blah blah, right?
Right.
And that's it. She eventually leaves of her own volition, you know. And that was the other thing too. It was always nice because I had to leave town. You know, these one nighters, man, literally.
Right.
The next fucking night, we're in the next town. Mm-hmm. One or the other. It was either Enid or Sayre, Oklahoma.
Right.
And another small... And I'm doing my show. And in... I'm on stage.
Mm-hmm.
And in from the back of the room, right, doors open, comes this fucking girl.
Uh-huh.
Dressed like she's going to a prom.
Mm.
Totally done up. Hair up. Full makeup, like a clown, like too much makeup.
Really? Yeah.
And a full.
I hate that. Yeah.
And a full,
no, you liked that.
No. Dig what I'm saying, man.
Yes.
She showed up unannounced, ready to go to a prom. Like, she had a full gown.
Wow.
And makeup. I'm talking, she fucking nuts.
Yeah.
I'm keeping it down right now because I don't want to make sure she don't fucking ruffle. I don't want anybody to fucking.
She won't hear you if you.
Okay. So the fucking girl shows up in the front fucking row of my fucking show, and. Never told me she was coming. No cell phones back then.
Mm-hmm,
no.
Mm-hmm.
Fucking show. She had found out, evidently, or maybe I mentioned the night before where we were going next.
Uh-huh.
She shows up. She sits in the front, doesn't laugh. She stares at me.
Really?
Fucking stares at me. Sam, to this day, if this girl showed up and fucking came at me with an axe, I would not be fucking shocked.
Really?
Well, I'd be shocked, but I wouldn't be like... She sits there in the front row, stares at me, doesn't move, doesn't budge. Doesn't clap, doesn't laugh.
Mm-hmm.
Full prom dress, like a bridesmaid.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, a gown, okay?
Right.
And again, the hair done up like an updo and with the little curls on the sides, like creepy.
So what was up with that? I mean, she was trying to get your attention?
She was fucking insane.
Yeah.
And she came back, she like wanted to get married.
Really?
So, like that kind of thing. She was like... and to be totally honest, there are times, you know, there are some things that you do sort of... squash, you know, you squash them. Mm-hmm. I've told this story maybe a handful of times because it's an interesting story. And every time I tell the story, the same thing happens. I always forget until about this point in telling the story when we were hanging out that night before.
Mm-hmm.
What there was one moment when we were talking, when she was talking about her and her dad are like best friends, etc., etc., and something about slow dancing and. So like creepy shit, like
right. Something.
And this girl was just some poor fucking, and I'm not saying it in a disparaging way, but just to give an idea of what we're talking about, this was just some fucking hick.
Yeah.
Some hayseed girl, this fucking farmer girl, this poor kid, talking about daddy dancing with her slow and all this shit. And now here I am making out with her and all that. Thank God I didn't fuck her. Thank God I didn't fuck her.
Thank God.
But anyway, you know, I had plenty of... Plenty of sex, you know. I had a fantastic life. No, the only times that life has gotten rough for me, or been tough for me, rather, mm-hmm. has been of my own doing.
Really,
my own doing. Yeah.
Isn't that usually the case, though?
You know, yeah, but you know, I tell
we
you,
all
like,
fuck up our lives,
you know, yeah. Sam, there was a time in this town when I was with the biggest agency in town.
Mm-hmm.
When, according to every major studio, I was the next Ray Romano. And I talk about it now free. This is not bragging because it didn't happen. There are people that would talk about their shortcomings and brag about it like it happened.
Right.
I'm just telling a story.
Right.
This is where I was at one point. And I fully admit that I fucked it up. I was a bad client. I was not a good client. I was annoying. I was demanding. I felt threatened by every other fucking comic on the planet.
Really?
The other comics that were represented by my agency. I was with an agency called ICM, and everybody's heard of William Morris. Well, ICM at that particular time was right there, if not bigger than William Morris at that time. They were a little hotter.
Right.
And I had a team. There was Team TJ is what there was. I had accountants, lawyers.
Really?
I
mean, nice.
Oh, God, I had business managers. I had everything. There was about probably 30% of my income was going to these different people. Mm. Thing is I fucked it up.
Yeah.
I fucked it up because, like I said, I resented. I would yell at my agent for even thinking about representing this other guy. Mm-hmm. I was offended by the presence of any other comic. And the thing is, though, is that I was a great comic, though. Mm. That's the thing. I was great at what I did. I was so fucking good at it. Right. And so that's why I've decided that I've got to go back. I've decided that I've got to go back to doing stand-up.
Really? That'll be cool.
Yeah, I'm going back.
Because you said you didn't want to, but you miss it, huh?
I miss it, and also, my daughter needs to have a dad with a cool job description.
Right.
My daughter, I want my daughter, I want to get back to doing what I did, and I think now I have a better handle on life. Now I've matured just that much, and I think that I'll be able to handle success. I mean, that's another thing, too. I didn't handle success very well.
Yeah.
You know, I lived in fear. I mean, there I was opening for the Beach Boys at Caesar's Palace. By the way, I finally got my headshot. I'm going to bring it in tomorrow morning. And I've also got a photo I want to put up here. It's a great black and white shot of the marquee at Caesar's Palace.
Oh.
And it says the Beach Boys, and it says TJ McCormick.
TJ McCormick.
And I've gotten people who found me on Facebook who sent me a message and go, back in 2000, I was in Vegas and I saw your name on the marquee, but the shows were sold out and I couldn't get a hold of you at the hotel. And it's funny. Oh, yeah, no, but it was very funny, too, because I remember I checked in. I remember I flew into Vegas. Caesars sent me a car and they picked me up. And they brought me over to the hotel, and what was really funny was I sat there. I checked into the hotel, and I went outside, and I sat and looking up at the marquee for about 20 minutes, looking at it, this big marquee that said, "This weekend, the Beach Boys, TJ McCormick." I said, "Wow!" I said, "Right now, there's like a couple of 100,000 people driving up and down the strip, looking at that marquee and going, wow, the Beach Boys.'" And,
that's amazing.
Who the fuck is TJ McCormick? You know what I mean? Yeah, that's what I say. My name was almost as big as their name, and they were like, "Who the hell is that?" And they must have been. Anyway, we have a visitor.
Our guest is in the studio. Good morning to you.
Good morning to you.
And please introduce yourself. TJ doesn't know you.
I have no idea who you are.
I'm Chris Ullman, and I have a project that we've launched called Help Is Nowhere.
Help Is Nowhere.
And it has to do with people having a train wreck in their lives. And how did they bootstrap their way out of it?
Huh.
Wow. So tell us a little bit. How did you get into this?
Well, what happened was I've been a doc for 30 years, and I retired to go into television. And in the process,
you've been a doctor?
Yeah, I was a doctor of chiropractic for 30 years in Manhattan Beach, treated the Lakers, professional volleyball, professional golfers. And but had always had an itch to get into television.
To do what?
I was writing scripts.
Okay.
We produced a television show that we showcased for ABC, NBC, CBS. Mm-hmm. And that was in 2006. Then what happened is what got dumped in my lap was I had a family member become a meth addict. And so in the process of going through that, I was attending these 12-step meetings.
Al-Anon. Well, I mean, whatever, 12-step meetings. Yeah.
Yeah, they don't like you to mention.
Right, I know, I just for some reason I don't always equate Al-Anon with the other 12 steps in terms of the anonymity. But okay. Right. Sorry, go ahead. That was just
that's the 11th
Freudian
tradition.
Slip. Yeah. Right. I'm aware of the tradition.
And so what happened was in this I started hearing these amazing stories about how people. One was this woman who decided to pack the lunches for the kids one day for school, drive them to school, drop them off, and this day she decides to go to the liquor store and buy an expensive bottle of vodka because usually in the afternoon she would drink cheap wine.
Right.
But this day she wanted to have something that tasted good because she was going to drink wash down a bottle of sleeping pills with it.
Oh, perfect.
Oh, very interesting.
And so
yes.
In the process, the hearing her story, and she actually started to go out until someone called. She thought it was the school. That's whoever calls.
Right.
And her life was saved. Mm. But she was a normal looking housewife, not a bag lady or a guy in a trench coat. And so I started hearing these stories of quiet desperation and thought, these stories have such a compelling nature to them.
Mm.
I think that if these people told their story, mm-hmm. that it would be interesting television. So we shot a demo, a pilot of it, and in the same process, we have a book coming out
mm-hmm.
of people who aren't comfortable being on camera telling mm-hmm. their story.
Fascinating.
And so we just finished that in August, and now we're pitching it.
Fantastic. So you shot a sizzle reel for it. You shot a spec pilot for it, or right. did you actually shoot the pilot? Or you just shot a spec?
Well, we crammed eight people, and mm-hmm. we staged it from their mm-hmm. youth. A lot of these kids started drinking when they were eight.
Oh, yeah, no. Yeah, wow. It's incredible when these things start.
And
yeah.
what happens is the situation with it is they discover at an early age something that makes them feel better mm-hmm. than anything else in their lives. They've right, never had... Right. that right. kind of a feeling, and so it kind of it fills in a hollowness
mm.
that is more than just you and I getting drunk mm. on the weekend. We wake right. up Monday, we're going the hangover, that's enough.
Right.
The hangover for them is the price they pay mm. so they can start drinking again.
Right. Well, and it's also about the drinking, the drug, the everything else, that's all a symptom. It's a symptom of a disease, and it's really what it comes down to is the behavior. There's a lot of people can walk away from booze, they can walk away from drugs, they can walk away from a lot of things, they can walk away from cigarettes and food,
right.
but it's the behavior that is really truly their demon, and it's what could it's what's sitting on their shoulder forever.
And you
and
hit
ever.
A great point
mm.
because one of the things that I have a problem with Dr. Mm. Drew Pinsky,
right.
Celebrity Rehab, and
Please.
With intervention is. Simply this, that they think in therapy, knowing the cause
mm-hmm.
of your behavior problem
mm-hmm.
corrects the problem behavior.
Mm.
And the truth is, it doesn't. Just because your mother didn't show up at the second grade play or
right.
you were abused in some way, that
mm-hmm.
might have started you into the drug.
Mm-hmm.
But what keeps you there is mm-hmm. the fact that the drug is doing you. So
yeah.
the theme of the show is...
And what's the title again?
HELPISNOWHERE. It can be pronounced either help is now here or help is
nowhere.
Right. And so when help is nowhere, it's because you're in the cauldron mm-hmm. of it and you can't get out.
Right.
And the thing I kept seeing in them, and I got this from the addicts,
mm-hmm.
is therapy wasn't working. Giving
mm-hmm.
them more drugs, mood-altering drugs
right.
wasn't working. The thing that happens is when they hit that bottom,
yeah.
they have the conversion.
I was just going to say, the bottom... that moment, not well. So I was going to say sometimes of clarity, but
right.
whatever it is, that moment is where the transition happens, and that is where they go from help is nowhere. When that moment, when they surrender, that is the transition. Help is nowhere. Help is now here.
Right, because
there is the moment.
In that moment of clarity, which has been overused a lot, but in that moment of clarity when you're talking to them,
mm-hmm.
I go, so what was different about this one?
Right.
And one of the gals that is involved in the project, she was driving down the road with her boyfriend,
mm-hmm.
and she decides to pull the emergency brake on the Range Rover,
mm-hmm.
flips it over,
mm-hmm.
misses, hits another car.
Mm.
Now, what it comes out of this is nobody gets hurt.
Mm.
She'd been trying to kill herself for a long time.
Yeah.
But the thought of her killing somebody else
right.
got her to that point, and she said in that split second, she was able to see her past life
mm.
and wonder if this would be her future life. And
mm.
at that point, she goes, do you really want to do this?
Mm.
Everybody who hits that point has something else come up.
Yeah.
So she'd been through rehab.
Mm-hmm.
Been arrested,
mm.
been through a ton of therapies.
Where's the bottom? Where's the bottom?
And
where's
then,
the bottom?
And yeah. as soon as you
death
get to
institution
the,
or death, right?
Yeah,
I mean
institutions, death
jail,
or jail
institution.
Jail is institution.
And,
death,
no,
yeah.
and nobody picks sobriety one morning because they wake up and they go like, "Yay, let's
yeah.
get sober."
Yeah,
they pick sobriety either from a hospital bed or a jail cell,
right?
Because their lives are such a freaking mess,
yeah.
that they go like, "Anything's better than this." And
yeah.
and all the. All the advice they had gotten up to that point that they didn't mm. listen to, blah, 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 they
yeah.
then turn into, I can't do it.
Right.
Tell me what to do. Help
yeah.
me out. They're open to the thing.
That's what it takes to. It takes a desire.
Yeah.
And it takes that moment. It takes that being willing, that willingness to be teachable, and a certain amount of desperation, all wrapped up in one. You know, your best candidate for someone to recover is someone who is teachable, who has a desire. But mainly, really, is desperate.
Yes.
Desperate.
Right.
desperate. That the person who knows that, that is arguably the best candidate. I mean, look, people lose their sobriety after 25 years because they decide to take some fucking cough syrup.
It's tough. Let's take a quick phone call.
Ah, please. Yes.
Good morning. You're on the air. Who's calling? Whoops. Hello?
Hello?
Yes.
Hi.
Hi.
I got an email. My name is Lucky. I'm an artist.
Okay.
To call this number.
You got an email to call this number. I think you're calling the wrong number, sir. You're on the radio station.
I'm an artist. I have sent the music out there. And I got an email last night that said to call this number. I don't know.
Okay. I think you're calling the wrong number. You're on the air. Okay. Thank you. I don't know what the heck, man.
One of the things interesting about the project is we're just not alcohol and addict based. The second phase of it is also talking about people that have financial calamities. So what was it that took them down? How far down did they go? How did they get down there?
Right.
How do they get out of it? So how do they bootstrap their way out? And what we're not looking for is a bunch of multi-level marketing people to come in. But what we're looking for is people that really lost everything.
Yeah.
And how do they reclaim it? Because to me, it's not about the addiction. It's that space, that small space where all of a sudden somebody flips their life around.
Mm-hmm.
What alteration, what conversion, what was the thing that made them do it? How did they resurrect it? In a way that they hadn't been able to do before.
What's an example of one of those?
I mean, would somebody do this if they hadn't hit bottom yet?
Well, here's an example. A fellow that used to build shopping centers in San Diego goes out to Texas, and he builds a mobile home park, an RV park, 700 spaces.
Mm-hmm.
Is doing very well. Ends up going through a divorce and loses everything.
Oy.
He loses it so bad that he has to move in with someone else. And then he marries that woman, and they go through all of her resources. And then they end up in Seattle living with her kids.
Jesus.
And so, and this fellow is a multimillionaire. And so I said to him, so what happened? He said, well, one of the things I had to do was purge myself of this intense anger and resentment at my ex-wife.
Yeah.
And so he was a builder. So his son-in-law had a piece of land. He said, do you want to build a house there? So they go ahead and they build the house, and they're going to sell it. Mm-hmm. And the story would be like then they kept building houses.
Right.
Well, the guy who bought the house just before escrow closes dies. So what he does is they move into the house anyway, but somebody across the street saw them building the house and said they wanted them to build a house. And so the story starts there where he then buys a piece of land from a guy who can't sell these 10 plots. Right. And he says, why don't you loan me the money to build the house and we'll split it? And he goes from that to building 700 homes in Seattle, outside of Seattle, Bingham, Washington. Now, here's the interesting part of it. He started this whole thing when he was 70.
Jeez.
And so there are more stories out there that we're accumulating that I can't talk about right now.
Oh, my God. Sure. So what's nice is for a guy like you with a project like this that, you know, you've got these different outlets for it in terms of, you know, Discovery, National Geographic, you know, all these wonderful outlets that carry a lot of this type of programming.
Right.
And so I take it you're going down all those avenues.
We're talking to mostly because I'm not a television producer,
mm-hmm.
and I might as well walk in and tell them I'm a pole dancer,
mm-hmm.
because the success you have with that, they want you to be with a producer. So what we're doing is we're pitching it to production companies,
right.
and producers with television bona fides,
mm.
and we just started, and we've gotten two or three rejections, but we know that
this will sell.
Yeah, we know that somebody out there.
Oh, this will sell.
Are going to feel it, and especially now because the economy is so far in the crapper.
Mm-hmm.
So many people are going to go down with the bubble that exploded,
mm-hmm.
and has taken us down maybe 50% of where we were.
Right. Mm.
The stories are rich out there,
mm-hmm.
and the people that are trying to make their lives work now, like our grandparents,
mm-hmm.
that were involved in the Depression, and you mm-hmm. hear the stories of how everybody moved into one room.
Sure.
And maybe the youngest...
Bootstrapped
it out. And so in that process,
mm-hmm.
people will not only be helped by it, but be inspired mm-hmm. by it. And without all that, The stories are phenomenal. They're very inspiring.
It's the human. It's the human experience. Yeah. It's in all its raw glory. Absolutely.
It's just how you guys got started in radio.
Yeah.
So tell us a little bit about your background. Did you grow up here in Southern California?
I actually grew up in Oklahoma.
Oh, okay.
Where the state question is, if you get a divorce, are you still cousins?
I was just telling a story about Oklahoma. I was just talking about an unfortunate occurrence between Enid and Sayre, Oklahoma.
Tulsa.
Look at that. Ah, well, there you go. Not that Tulsa is the unfortunate experience. It's something that happened to me. Yeah. But, Tulsa. Oh, wow.
And all those people out there in Oklahoma, don't write in or call in.
Yeah, it's just whatever. No
but
big deal.
I want you to be able to boomer sooner tonight when they start on Florida.
You know what? I hate all the teams from Florida. Miami, Florida, Florida State. I can't stand them. I'm a big, big 12 guy.
Who are you picking?
I'm a big 12. I'm going OU. I'm going Oklahoma. Yeah, absolutely. I'm an OU guy, and I was a Texas Tech guy until Bob Knight started. I love Bob Knight. What can I say? I was a big fan.
Anybody who can throw a chair in the middle of a basketball game.
Absolutely.
Is a good coach.
So you're from Oklahoma originally, and how'd you find your way here?
I was raised in Tulsa, and then I got a job in Vietnam with the Army.
Uh-huh.
Oh, yeah. That's a great freaking job.
I've never heard it put that way before. I got a job in the Army. Oh, that's really funny. I got a job in the Army. That's very funny.
So were you overseas?
I was overseas. I was 11B40. We were in short range ambush patrols.
Thank you for your service. Thank you. God bless you.
And we spent, for every kill, we spent 10,000 rounds shooting at trees and, you know, birds and whatever else.
Wow. Killing time.
So it was the Army that couldn't shoot straight. but I got a Purple Heart, and I was wounded in combat. I had my heart broken in a horror house.
That's a big injury right there.
Especially in Nam.
So the Army compensated you for it.
My Ling, she's got my heart.
My Ling, there you go.
So then after that, I came back to California because I had just visited once and just felt like this is where I belong. Mm-hmm. And so I lived down in Mission Beach, then decided to become a chiropractor because life as a bartender with people wasn't working.
Right.
So I went back to college and went to chiropractic school and then came out to Manhattan Beach where I've been for 30 years and have a practice in Manhattan Beach.
Yeah. Wow.
That's a beautiful area.
That I sold to my partner. He's working it now.
You know, good for you, but I tell you what, you know, Sam asked me just before you came in, for some reason he wondered, you know, if I've had he said, yeah, have I had a good life? I've had an easy life.
Right.
You know, that's awesome to me that you went. You had that awful experience of having. I'm assuming it was an awful experience going to Nam and doing what you had to do over there. And then you know what's nice is that you followed your heart. You had a little bit of a vision there, and you didn't just go to California. You settled in arguably like two of the nicest places that California has to offer. Ended up in Manhattan Beach, right? Doing chiropractic, doing what? Man, you've had a very blessed life.
Going back to Vietnam, I like to tell people it's a $1 million experience you wouldn't pay a nickel for. But it's a rich experience, and you know, and it was a good experience. Mm. And I honor the guys. I kid around about the Purple Heart. I did get one in combat, and I salute the fellas that lost their lives there.
Sure. Well, those are the heroes. Ask a fellow like this who are the heroes. They call him a hero.
Yeah.
His buddies that he left back there, they're the heroes.
And the guys that are in Iraq and Afghanistan, you know, the thing about those wars, whether they're popular or not, you look at the guys there, and, you know, when you sign up, you don't get to pick your battles.
Yeah.
You don't get to pick your wars. You go there to serve the country.
Right.
And whether we like it or not, our hats should always be off to those guys.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. And that, by the way, there's a fertile ground for you with this show, is potentially going and finding some of these fellas who have come back and are going to have to bootstrap themselves out of, I mean, not just the PTSD type situation that these guys could find themselves in, or the obvious, the limbs and the things and the injury. Right. But, you know, guys coming home to, you know, some of these guys went into the Army or had a, or were called back in or whatever, called up 2-3 years ago when we were kind of rolling right along, and now they're coming back. This is interesting. Now they're coming back
right.
to a totally FUBAR economy.
And,
you
and
know?
On top of it, we did one tour of service.
Right.
Some guys did two in Vietnam. Mm. The lifers did.
Right.
But these guys are reservists.
Right.
National Guard guys right. that are doing 2-3.
These are ad executives. These are guys working at the, yeah, the, I mean, guys the, working at the Jiffy Lube and doing whatever.
And they can't get out of the service.
Right.
So, yeah, this is these guys are paying a price that I don't think anybody understands.
Yeah.
And you're right. We've also incorporated into that talking about guys that have had. And normally, they're having financial calamities.
Sure.
Because they've lost their real means of income. Mm. Their wives are staying home raising the kids, or the wives are fighting,
picking up a job or two, or something.
The wives are over in Iraq, and
right,
the,
vice
the
versa.
Guys are raising. So I mean, yeah, it's a struggle. That I think we're all going to be experiencing fairly soon with the way things seem to be going.
Oh, yeah. I don't think anybody really is, you know, there are certain industries that they say are, you know, that can weather any storm that are sort of recession-proof, and, you know, one of them being entertainment. You know, I tell you what, it's just because it's because this whole thing is affecting the market, because this really is, like somebody yesterday was talking about, it's not so much the prices of the houses these days. It's not so much the real estate market, it's about the lending. It's like if you want to go, and you even if you've got that spectacular credit, you got to go right now. If you want to buy a house right now, you got to come up with like 30-40% down.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, in some cases, and nobody has that scratch, especially so it's a perfect storm, especially considering normally in order to raise that cash, you drop some stocks, you liquidate some stuff. There's nothing left to liquidate, or if it is, it's 12 cents a share. So what's happening is I think I would not be surprised if we already saw it a little bit with Ed McMahon and that whole thing with that poor guy. But, you know, I think we're going to start seeing this thing, the ramifications starting to hit. You know, there'll be one of these muckety mucks. You know, whether it be a Katzenberg or a Spiel, I think there's going to be a couple of unbelievable names.
Failures.
That are going to be, I'm sorry?
The failures.
Yeah, that are going to end up going under. And, you know, and they're going to need to be making their $20 million flicks to simply get back even, you know?
Right.
I'm just saying, this is interesting. It's a fascinating time.
I think when you start to look at the problem was we inflated our assets and then borrowed against them.
Yeah.
And then if you remember when Paulson came on September 15th, is he wanted to clear out the toxic debt.
Mm-hmm.
And the way to clear out the toxic debt was to get the $750 billion TARP bailout and do that. But the truth is they didn't know how big the debt was.
No, once they started scratching.
And so then they figured out that the debt, to clean out the toxic debt is the wrong thing to do.
Right.
So then they decided to just start buying parts of banks and giving the money to the banks, which we still don't know where that money went.
Yeah.
But the truth of the matter is the way we got out of the Depression, it's a simple thing. The way we got out of what do you think the
we got to attack Germany is what we got to do.
We
got to go back and kick Germany's ass.
We have to go to war somewhere.
War usually stimulates the economy.
I prefer Germany. Well, they're still a little uppity for my liking. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
Well, a couple of things are. Well, number one is following any financial instability for long periods of time creates geopolitical problems.
Right.
So that's another thing that Barack Obama is going to be dealing with.
Yeah.
But the debt ratio right now, the national debt is 40% of GDP. What do you think it was at the end of World War II?
Similar,
120%.
Good Lord!
Jeez.
So we're a little bit removed from that kind of.
But what we have to do is we have to go ahead and create a package, the stimulus package. I think for $800 billion doesn't seem to be enough.
Mm-hmm.
I think what they have to do is create a thing called recovery bonds, because what got us through World War II was war bonds.
The war bonds, yes.
And they were sold by Hollywood stars and all that. And that was because people were investing back in the country. We couldn't afford that war.
Right.
So we can't afford this either. So we have to get the people that are holding money to get them to reinvest back in America in recovery bonds.
Yeah.
And then create a real economy that starts at the bottom up.
Yeah.
Not just keep trying to extend the credit bubble.
Right.
Because people aren't loaning and people can't
borrow. We have to actually, I think what it is this is like after an earthquake, we have to go down and we have to assess and retrofit The foundation. We have to go and we have to put in some rebar and we have to put in some supports and rebuild the foundation and then, like you said, go from there up and not just sort of get all this fluff going and the credit and all that theoretical money flying around electronically, but rather get down to it, get some, you know, get some money in some pockets, some money in some banks, get some commerce going, et cetera. What do you think about evidently Barack wants to start, I think it was something like 600,000 new government jobs. I don't know.
Well, I think what he has to do is, first off, the only thing is we're the biggest thing we're missing right now is confidence. There's a loss of trust in it. Hank Paulson and Bernanke, they've lost credit with just about everybody because they tried this thing and it was a big panic.
Yeah,
we kind of got panicked into it like we got panicked into Iraq.
Yeah,
and so when this was going on, a lot of the Republicans in the room were sitting back. Conservatives are going like, "Well, wait a minute, what is the problem?"
Right,
and the only problem they knew was there was a calamitous failure. Lehman Brothers.
Right.
Bear Stearns had already happened. Citigroup was about to go down. All these
AIG
Goldman Sachs.
Was that next one? Yeah.
And I think one of the phenomenas is, do you ever wonder if somebody that was running the Treasury was in the car company, was in the car business, would those loans have been going to the car industry quicker than they are now? And I think Hank Paulson and the fellas back east that are dealing with this are all, I don't want to say in bed, but I think that there's a collegiality amongst those guys on Wall Street.
Right.
So when these guys are stepping up going, we're too big to fail, somebody needs to write a book called We're Too Big to Fail.
Yeah.
And show how we're failing anyway.
Yeah. You know, today, article in the LA Daily News, or it might be an AP article, but there's an article about how Chrysler is, first of all, got no shot of survival. No shot.
Really?
They're spending $7 billion every 42 days.
Wow.
Every 42 days, they are going through $7
billion. $7
billion? And you know, and I tell you, I am definitely fiscally conservative. I'm politically conservative for sure. That's how I vote. And you know, I mean, I mean, there are ramifications when you say who should have let some of these firms fail. I mean, gosh, I mean, okay,
But how about the fact that they're going to fail anyway?
You see, that's what I'm saying. Is they're going to fail anyway? Yeah. And I guess my thought was, though, is that I guess you couldn't just say, we'll let them fail, because, again, the ramifications of just letting GM go, it's like, well, what happens if you own a GM car? I mean, just simple, actual, just rudimentary questions like that. What happens if you own a GM car? And does GM just go away? You know, and then it's like, what about the rubber cut? What about the electronics? What about all the wiring
it
firms?
Would
and all?
Disastrous. You
it
know?
Would That's be massively think... disastrous. But like you just said, they're gonna fail anyway. This is know what I think we're kind of fucked here.
Yeah,
yeah. Well, we are.
I think we're kind of screwed.
No, I think you're right. And I think that the thing is, they're gonna bail these guys out. And they said that there's a 20 somewhere in February. They're going to have to do something else. If people stop buying these products, and not just GM but Toyota
just showed the first loss, operating loss in the history of the company.
Yeah. Really?
The history. Jeez. That's how good Toyota's been from the get-go.
Right. But so, I'm surprised. I mean, I know they've become almost number one car maker, right?
They've had their bad months and their bad quarters, but this is their first operating loss ever.
And this is rippling out throughout the economy. So when that credit bubble that burst back in September, it meant that maybe $5 to $8 trillion of the economy was being driven by credit. So when that credit goes away, and that's what they kept talking about, we need to get the credit markets moving again, we got to get people loaning money. When you're losing your job, I mean, the second and third wave of this foreclosure mess is showing up in the Alt-A loans and the adjustables.
Right.
And so when that starts to show up and these guys and we can't make those home payments and people are losing their jobs, this is the perfect storm of an economic collapse.
Yeah.
And so what my suggestion to Barack Obama is, be bolder than $800 billion. Be bolder than $2, $3, $4, $5 trillion.
Yeah.
Because what has to happen is, when you got money in your pocket and it's coming in once a week as a job, then the economy comes up from a solid base. And here's the killer on part of this. We were making so much money in the credit market, like in the money market accounts and all that.
Right.
There's no savings.
Right.
So,
instead, yeah, there's no actual those passbook savings anymore. There's very little. Just, you know, put in the $50, $100. It's all this money markets and do this and do the IRAs and all this fancy schmancy type of savings.
Right. So what they need to do is take the IRAs and take all the retirements if people are up for this, and I think most Americans are, and invest that in maybe T-bills, call them recovery bills or whatever it is. Invest back into the government.
Yeah.
And be part of the investment and rebuilding it. Yeah. And hopefully this administration will be more competent in dispersing the money, picking the projects that are good to build.
Yeah.
Because right now in California, what's our deficit going to be?
Oh, well, California...
$42 billion.
We're going to have to sell California.
Yeah.
They're going to have to unload. Somebody's got to unload California.
I mean, $42 billion.
It's going to be, you know what? They're going to sell the naming rights to California. It's going to be, you know,
Northern Mexico.
Chevron's California. You know what I mean? It's going to be like, you know, it's going to be like Citi Field or whatever. You know, and I think too, you know, what it is it keeps coming back to, California is totally screwed right now. We're also going to need some a lack of like you said, you're going to need more competence, because all of this is about competence. We're also going to need a little lack of selfishness. In other words, a little bit more national pride, a little more nationalism.
Yeah, but you know, and what? When it comes down to your wallet, you know, there's
well,
no
this
such
is what
thing,
I'm saying. No, but and that's what I mean. In order for some of this stuff to work, it's going to take, like, to invest in T-bills, to take some of this retirement and take it out of IRAs and take it out of these ethereal.
Big investors can do, you know. Small investors can't.
Well, the other thing is too, though, is I think too, is that, you know, talk about the small, because anytime I think about the most recent thing that irritated me about the California situation was Schwarzenegger came up with it. At least it was an idea, you know, about a mandatory 2-day work for whatever without pay. And boom, here you see, I got a big problem with unions. I got a big problem with unions. I think the state of California is completely beholden to unions. As soon as he wants to cut something somewhere along the line, here comes the teachers union talking about, oh God, the kids.
Prison guards.
Oh, for the love of Christ. You know, so my thing is too, and the UAW, I think it's going to take a movement amongst a lot of these, I think in a lot of ways, very self-serving, and well, that's why they're built. That's why they were built, these unions, to be self-serving. I'm not totally indicting, you know, but I think it's going to take the rank and file to stand up and tell the leadership of some of these unions that I've got a stranglehold on somebody. I mean, you can draw a direct line in some cases, you know, point A, point B, you know, between the state that some of these big three and other industries are in. That is directly correlated to the stranglehold that these unions have on them.
Well, the contracts with the unions, of course, nobody was holding a gun to the manufacturers.
Not at the time, when they
But things were fat, and there was we were making a product that was capturing the American car product was capturing 40%, 50%, 60%, and so what they've asked the unions to do in this bailout for the auto companies is to, we want you guys to make the same money that they're paying Toyota manufacturers
down south. Right.
And I don't know if they're, what they need to do is get rid of a lot of the legacy costs, which is a guy who's laid off for 5 years is still collecting. Then they retrain them.
The unemployment and the retirement benefits are insane.
And here's a crazy, and I'm a conservative too, but here's a crazy idea I think we finally have hit. Mm. And this is coming from a doc.
Right.
I think we have to go to nationalized healthcare.
Wow.
And I think the reason we have to go to nationalized healthcare is because if you start looking at the cost, there was just a thing on PBS last night on Jim Lehrer about how these little this little flower shop, some of these people are paying $1,000 a month for insurance.
I am paying nearly $1,000 a month.
And so what happens is in the process is every product that you're making, you have to factor in that you're paying somebody's healthcare coverage.
Yes.
Now, in a global economy, we're competing against Germany, France, England, Japan, Canada, which have nationalized healthcare coverage.
Right.
And so somehow they have to figure out how to get the burden of that expense off of industry so they can become more competitive.
I must say, I have never, and I'm always quick to call a spade when I'm the spade. I must say, I have never, and my wife is a business owner. She doesn't do healthcare. She's not that kind of business. She has a lot of, you know, independent contractors and stuff. But anyway, the point is that I've never really looked at it from that perspective, and I pride myself on looking from all angles, and I never did really consider that. So I need to reassess here. That's interesting. We need to take the idea of nationalized healthcare would take the burden of healthcare off of a lot. That's fascinating. I never really dawned on
that. That's part of the legacy cost of every business.
And I can see where a conservative could – that's probably like that the one way. That yeah. one that a conservative yeah. – and also I think as long as we have the option to go – to do private, right. if we have the means, the wherewithal to go private, you know.
And we talk about the credit bubble that was bloated. Mm-hmm. We have a somewhat of a bloated expense here for healthcare mm-hmm. because while we're the most expensive per capita, mm-hmm. we rank like 23rd and 30th in longevity behind all these countries that have it.
Right.
And some of them don't have it. So what we're getting for our healthcare dollar here, we can probably shrink that by, I don't know, a third.
Right.
And have a better fit population. So all of this feeds right into the project. Where
once again, what's the name of the project again? We've gotten off.
Yes, well, we have to wrap up, Chris.
Help
so
is now
go
here.
Ahead. Help is now here, or come, help is nowhere.
Right,
right. And
can I give a contact?
Of course,
My email is docn8@roadrunner.com. So it's DOC David Oscar Charlie, N as in Nancy, the number 8.
Okay.
At roadrunner.com. Help is nowhere. The website is being constructed as we speak.
Awesome. Well, wonderful, best of luck wonderful. With that. That's going to be doing some good work.
Course, absolutely, right. absolutely. And all the best to you. Good luck with the program and everything. TJ?
I'll be back here tomorrow with Johnny. We're planning on doing the three of us tomorrow.
That's true. That's true. And you have your own show in an hour?
In an hour. Right. In an hour, I'm on.
Stay tuned for Real Estate Recap with Dan and Doug. And what do you think, TJ?
I love you.
You love me. Thank you.
What else is
the
there
love
to
is
say?
In the air.
What else is there to
the
say?
Love
go fuck
is in
yourself.
The air.
Go fuck yourself. Go fuck yourself, everybody.
All right.
Have a great day.
Sam and Susie in the Morning, which airs every weekday at 9 a.m. Pacific. To contact the show, please email your question or comment to sam@latalkradio.com or susie@latalkradio.com. A complete list of all past shows can be found on our archives page and on iTunes. For sponsorship or advertising information, email us at info@latalkradio.com. Sam and Susie in the Morning is a presentation of LA Talk Radio at latalkradio.com. LA Talk Radio, we say what we want.